While it used to be considered much more of a European beverage or part of European culture, wine is definitely part of North American culture now. It shows up in our movies, on our dinner tables, in our TV shows, in general discussion. It's also a major industry, especially in Ontario and in British Columbia, where the wine industries are growing, they're thriving, but they could be doing even better. Hello and welcome to the Full Comment Podcast. My name's Brian Lilly, your host. And today I wanted to look more at the business of wine and what we could do to make Canada a powerhouse in wine the way New Zealand has been able to do, or Australia. It wasn't that long ago that you just simply didn't grow grapes for making drinkable wine in Canada. It was something that people would do as a hobby, but it wasn't something we were known for. One man, and the man we're going to speak to today, helped change that. Donald Zeraldo went from being a hobbyist to putting Canada on the map, especially when it came to ice wine. He's one of the founders of Inniskillen, and even though he sold that company years ago, remained somewhat involved, and now has his own wine label, Zeraldo Estate Winery, he is someone deeply involved in the making of wine, the promotion of wine, the sale of wine in Canada, and seemed like a good guest to discuss how we take Canadian wine to the next level and how we got from, well, where we were to where we are now. Donald Zeraldo joins me from his home in Niagara-on-the-Lake, Ontario. Donald, thanks for the time today.
My pleasure. I
wonder if you could take us back to the beginning. I know you're at a new beginning now with your Zeraldo Estates Winery, but take us back to the beginning of when you really helped boost the Ontario wine business and built a company that is known around the world now out of nothing. How did an Italian guy and a German guy start a winery with an Irish-sounding name in southern Ontario? How the heck does that happen?
Well, first he was Austrian, so just
My apologies.
That's right. Kaiser was from Austria. Kaiser, I mean, I grew up on a farm. After I finished University of Guelph, I went back to the family farm in St. Catharines, and Carl Kaiser had dropped in to buy some plants that didn't taste Canadian. Vitis labrusca, right? It's like my dad, they just can't handle fragolino, as it's called back home, which I just came back from Italy, and they're always thinking it's a real treat for me to have a fragolino. It's called Clinton, the variety. And I'm like, please, guys, this has been my nemesis all my life. Just give me some picolite or some Pinot Grigio or something. Sauvignon Blanc from Friuli. So Carl literally came to buy some plants. And
he wanted to plant some vines and grow some grapes to make wine.
Yeah, just for himself. He'd married a Canadian, Sylvia, and he was working at a machine shop somewhere in St. Catharines, and he was enrolled at Brock. Fortunately, he took biochemistry, so he learned the scientific aspects of it, but he learned the art of winemaking at the monastery where he grew up in Sandweit in Germany. So that's really how innocently started. He came, I gave him some Deschanac grapevines. He went and he bought some, I think, from Mr. Moyer, the farmer, up in the bench. Brought me back a bottle of wine. I was so impressed. I said, well, who made this? He said, I did. And I guess he somewhat jokingly said, well, why don't I make it and you sell it? And I said, well, Carl, this is Canada. It's not how it works here. It's called a monopoly in LCBO. So I literally went to Toronto and very innocently just walked in, asked the vice president, Mr. Harris, and he kind of chuckled.
This is the vice president of the LCBO.
The LCBO, that's right.
In Toronto. So you walk into one of the biggest liquor operations, sales operations in the world, and say, hey, can you sell my wine?
Well, I didn't have wine to sell. I just wanted a permit to make it, and because that's what I was told I had to get. So he said they didn't really have any application forms, and they hadn't given one out since 1929. So I kind of sheepishly left, came back, told Carl to forget it. And then General George Kitching, who was the chairman of the LCBO, retired general, he wrote a letter and he asked if he could see me. And I drove back up to Toronto. I think I packed a suitcase back in those days. So we're talking in 73. And he said, listen, I drank a lot of great wine during the war. I don't know where they got it from in Germany and France, but I can just imagine. They probably helped themselves to some of the best. And he said, I really like would appreciate if you could do something, you know, some great wine, because I understand you want to do European style wines, blah, blah, blah. So it was honestly that innocent. And he became my our mentor. And it really was a question of whenever I need anything, I'd phone him up and I'd say General. And everybody called him General. Nobody called him Mr. Kitching, or nobody called him George for sure. Ramrod, straight sick. And he really was instrumental over the next 2 years. And he phoned up one day and he said, Donald, I got some great news for you, but I got some bad news. The bad news is you can't tell anybody. The good news is you just got the first license since Prohibition to make wine from the Ontario government. And he and Bob Welsh, who was the deputy premier and the rep around the area here. So that really is how innocently it started. And because I was growing grapevines, I'd always had an interest. My dad had grapes, peaches, cherries, had everything. It was a mixed fruit farm. And so I came up here to Niagara Lake, and we basically agreed that we'd make a couple barrels of wine in my dad's basement on Ontario Street, where we got the manufacturing permit for. And then in the packing shed in Niagara on the lake, fruit packing shed, we put in a few barrels that we got from the liquor board through Kitching, and started in Enniskillen in 1975. And the real big break came with the ice wine. And it's going to fast forward because, you know, there was trials and tribulations of starting any business. You know, it was a startup and we did it on the back of a farm. And Carl was still teaching. I was running the farm. And basically, that's really how innocently it started. Two guys in a garage, which they now call garagistes.
That's fantastic. I don't think people realize how stifled anything to do with alcohol was for so many years. Yeah, we left Prohibition back in the 30s, but the mentality didn't necessarily change. I remember going with my dad as a kid to the LCBO, and he would have to fill out a form hand it to them, and he would have to tell them his address and his route home, and you were supposed to go directly home. You couldn't go anywhere else with a bottle of booze. It was very very provincial in how we looked at these things. And that's not just Ontario. It was across the country. And, you know,
they put it in brown. I mean, people would probably laugh. They should have a video to show it, because they were behind a counter. You filled out that paper. You went up, put it, you gave it to them. They went in the back somewhere, put it in a brown paper bag and handed it to you. And that's if, you know, at those times, very few women would be in shopping. So, yeah, it was a different time. Sundays you couldn't drink because it was, you know, Hyde Park, you couldn't drink, period. That was one of the writings. So, yeah, it was different times. But if you look, there's a video called CBC. It's a documentary. It's called Geraldo Zapp. It's in the CBC archives. You really got to watch it to get a sense of how crazy it all seemed at the time. But, you know, as I listen to it, it's pretty simple. You know, we just started and we went from there. We just decided we were going to use European grapes. And then here's another sort of one of these issues that seems like crazy now, but I had grafted 30,000 grafted grapevines, because all the viniferas technically have to be grafted onto rootstocks that are resistant to phylloxera, which the native grapes are resistant to, so they're not an issue. So when I grafted these 30,000 vines, the official word was that it was too cold to grow vinifera in Canada. There was some experimenting going on at Bright's Winery on here in Niagara, and also Chateau Gay, which is owned by Labatt's. But nobody was commercializing it, so I couldn't sell these 30,000 vines, so I bought the Jeffries Farm, which is now the Seeger Vineyard, and planted all 30,000, Riesling, Chardonnay, and Gamay. And at that time, in 1977, we had a disastrous harvest, which you'll see in the video if you watch that CBC documentary. There was trials and tribulations, you know, some good, some bad, a lot of fun. We were naive and young enough to not worry about it, work 24/7. Carl had come here after his work at the university. And like I said, the big break came in 1971 when we took the ice wine.
81 with the ice wine.
No, we made the ice wine in 83. Well, we didn't make it 83, sorry, because the birds ate it all. 84, after we learned to cover them with netting. So 84, but the 91 was the year we won the Grand Prix d'Honneur in France, which just exploded us into the world.
I want to get to that in a minute, but I want you to explain for people that aren't real winos. When you talk about grafting the grapes, you wanted to grow European style grape varieties in Canada, but you couldn't plant those directly, so you had to graft a vine from Europe onto a native vine from here in North America?
Well, it gets a little complicated. I'll try and simplify it. Vitis riparia, which you'll see growing on fence hedges, up in trees, you know, if you're anywhere around southern Ontario or eastern seaboard of the United States, you see these grapevines growing all over the bush. That's Vitis riparia. Very resistant to the cold, very resistant to phylloxera, which is a root louse. The European varieties, which is Vitis vinifera, to distinguish it from Vitis riparia or Vitis labrusca, which is Concord, Niagara. Those Chardonnay, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Pinot Grigio, all those European varieties have to be grafted onto resistant rootstocks here in all over the world, for that matter, with the exception of possibly parts of Chile and parts of New Zealand. I think that's about it. But it's a safety precaution to stay away from this louse because eventually it'll invade. So when Jack Cartier, whoever took the wild vines from eastern seaboard, along with tobacco from Virginia, pineapple from South America, tomatoes, took them back to Europe, they also brought this root louse along, and it just about wiped out the industry in the middle 1800s. So wiping out the wine industry in the middle 1800s was pretty fundamental because that was a staple. You know, wine is part of the food culture in Europe, and you know the Roman soldiers used it as their Gatorade because they gave them energy. The water was too polluted. So that whole basis is now the basis of our premium wines, all grafted on these grapevines. And the irony is that the origin of these wild vines came from North America, and all of the grapevines in Europe were grafted as well on North American rootstocks.
When you started out, and, you know, I'm going to use some of the brand names of your competitors down the street. Baby Duck, I think that was Peller had Baby Duck.
Andrew Peller and his son John, who left being a doctor in Hamilton to. I guess he created Baby Duck. It became a real phenomenon, as you know.
Yeah. So you know, when I've talked to the Pellers, you know, they said, we had to make wine that people would drink, and they didn't know wine very well in Canada back then. It wasn't a thing. I grew up in an immigrant neighborhood in Hamilton, so most of my neighbors made their own wine, and you get introduced to it that way. But they're trying to sell it, and they had to find something sweet, something palatable. Did you have to do much of that in the early days of saying, okay, What will Betty Sue buy at the liquor store? What can I make that they'll actually buy?
I didn't do any market research because, you know, it's like I look back now, I can look at Steve Jobs. Nobody did market research and said, we need a iPhone with a screen on it. He just did it. And, you know, we just took what the Europeans were doing, what Carl knew how to do because he came from Europe. And I drank wine at home with my dad. He never made wine from Labrusca. And the other thing that caught my attention was when I did travel to Europe, even going back to Friuli, where my family's from, they grow peaches, cherries, lemons, but mostly grapes up that far north. And if you go up to Germany and Switzerland, they don't grow peaches and cherries there. So I thought, it seems odd that they can do that and we cannot. So being in the nursery business, I tried it, and I found it very intriguing to do the grafting. There's a community near my family's hometown in Italy called Rauschedo. And as you know, in Europe, they do a lot of cluster industries. And they do, you know, Spilimbergo does mosaics, San Daniele does prosciutto, Fiat in Turin does automobiles. And in Rauschedo, they do 100 million grafted vines shipped all over the world. We couldn't bring them in as rooted vines because the viruses. So I would bring the rootstocks that they grew. And they were actually cultivated from the original species here. And then I would graft them because we then go along and pick the clones. So over time, where the industry is really evolving is that we are picking clones, which are a selection from a block of vineyard, take those buds and graft them so that we adapt to our climatic conditions more and more. Just as they did when the Romans planted all of Europe, they planted everything all over. And then slowly, you know, Burgundy became famous for Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, Riesling in Germany, et cetera, et cetera. So in here, it evolved from the Bruscas, the Concord Niagara, through the hybrid period, which is sort of a stepping stone. But then we quickly learned that if you had the right management, and the people that were very helpful in the management were the German and Italian immigrants, like the Seegers, the Schulas, people in Collio, De Luca. They thought, you know, we can grow Riesling in Germany. Why shouldn't we be able to grow it here where there's peach orchards right beside us? And they were very instrumental in pushing the needle forward because they had no resistance to the old way of doing it.
How much effort did it take to convince Canadian consumers to try this?
I'm still working on it.
What do you mean?
Well, I spent most of my time outside of Canada, and for two reasons. One is, you know, it's very hard to convince Canadians. If you're making a Canadian film, or if you're a Canadian actor or a singer, you pretty much got to go to the United States to become famous. So I thought, you know, maybe we need to go somewhere to become famous so that Canadians will appreciate us. And we got lucky in 91 when we won the Grand Prix d'Honneur, and then shortly after the Grand Premio in Italy. The wine world told the world that we made the best dessert wine in the world when we won the Grand Prix d'Honneur. And that did it. And then it just exploded from there. And particularly the Japanese, who were visiting Niagara Falls a lot, they discovered it because they thought, wow, these Canadians who we, I mean, who the hell ever heard of Canadian wine outside of Canada? And the fact was that the Japanese were here. They visited. They loved it. Nice packaging. They love the whole idea of gifting, which they do a lot in the Asian community. So we locked into that, and we'd get 5-6 bus tours from JTV Tours. They'd come in 23 minutes. You could almost set your watch to their schedule. They'd come in, they'd get armfuls of ice wine, go back. We even set up a shop transportation, courier service. And then I hopped on a plane and went to Japan, and we did duty-free, did the airlines, and we kind of just spread around. And I was doing that 24/7, 200 days a year, flying around selling ice wine. Because people got it psychologically, Canada and ice wine. It just made a lot of sense.
And if you've tried it, and I have, both at the Inniskillen shop and at home on, let's say, ice cream or in a glass, it's good.
The best way people say to me, how do you sell it? I just ask people to taste it, and then I don't have to say anything. Usually the reaction is, wow, especially at the beginning when they hadn't tried it. Sommeliers were great, you know, very instrumental. They had discovered it. They started putting it into their global competitions, and it just started to spread like wildfire. All I had to do was just try to keep up.
The amazing thing that I remember, I did a special tour of Inniskillen several years ago, and they described how you'd worked with Rydell Glassware to come up with specific glasses, and they had us try the ice wine several different ways and then tried it in the glass designed for ice wine to hit at the right spot on your tongue. And you're sitting there thinking, uh-huh, yeah, this is a way to sell me a really expensive glass. Right. And then you try it and you go, oh my God, that tastes so much better.
Yeah, it was a work in progress because George Riedel's Austrian, as Carl is. So Carl, who was the genius behind ice wine, I mean, the guy just like, he just know how to do it. I guess he was gifted having learned it, you know, in his homeland. And what we did with Riedel initially was we sat 16 experts down, had four different ice wines in front of us. Carl and George Riedel were conducting the tasting at the Hyatt in Toronto. And we had, I think, 13 different glasses. 6 hours later, you know, wine people, like all of us, love to argue about which one's the best, which is glasses best, which best corkscrew, blah, blah, blah. And so we couldn't settle after 6 hours. So George said, look, fine. I get the three finalists. There's the port glass, a Sauternes, and a Sauternes port, and a Sauvignon Blanc glass. So he said, let me take this back. And he came up with a prototype. We shipped that around, and that became the glass. And the best thing I can say about it is when Carl was presented with the glass, and, you know, he spent 20 minutes, half an hour swishing it and tasting, he said to George Riedel, this is exactly how I wanted my ice wine to taste. Yeah, it's the delivery. It's all about the way, the design. And let me give your listeners an opportunity to get to deep dive into not only the ice wine, but into the Riedel hand-blown crystal we made. If you go to my website, zeraldo.ca, and you go under menu, scroll down to book, and then under book, you'll see electronic version. It's a $20 payment. But if you put in the discount box, which is a gift from me to you and your listeners, put Vidal, which is the hybrid, the famous hybrid that we make ice wine from, put that in the discount box, and you'll get a copy of my book, Ice Wine, which Carl and I wrote, and you will have everything imaginable you'd ever want to know about ice wine and its creation and a lot of its evolution. And also the terroir in our region, you know, what makes the Niagara region below the escarpment and Lake Ontario so unique in its ability to make wine, ice wine.
Well, it is amazing, and I've enjoyed, you know, examining different wine regions across the country. The only place I haven't been yet is Okanagan. I got to fix that. But let's talk about this across the country. You said, to get Canadians to appreciate something, you had to go to the States. Speaking with a friend a little while ago, he said, you know what? We treat the wine industry as an afterthought. This could be a huge industry, much bigger than it is, but it doesn't get the support. Between the fact that we've got trade barriers and how governments view it, what's your take on that idea that wine could be a major industry, but it's not reached its potential.
No, and I'll tell you, I can sit and bitch and complain, which, you know, often happens too much. But I think the reason that Carl and I were successful, we just put our heads down and just made quality wine. And he made great wine, and I was tasked with the idea of leaving the vineyard and going and selling it to the world. And it worked, because we just didn't take a second seat. Carl made an amazing quality. It was blessed by the French and by the Italians. And what was great, I'll give you a couple examples. One example, Marchese Piero Antinori or Sandro Boscaini from Mazzi, both in two different instances at a gala dinner, asked me to speak on behalf of the Zer wine, ice wine, because they were serving their wine, Ricciotto in the case of Mazzi from Verona, and Piero Antinori from Tuscany with, you know, his great Sesicaios, and he was serving Vinsanto. And they both said, look, you know, these are nice wines, you know, but they're not our main. They're just something we do because we all make a dessert wine. You want to take a great dessert wine, taste ice wine from Canada. And that, you know, that's, you can't buy that kind of publicity. So that was really fundamentally what we did, like actors going on stage, was to get the Europeans to sanction us. And, you know, many of the wineries, as I said the other day, I read that Decanter did a great spread on the Pinot Noirs and Chardonnays from, specifically from, I think it was just Ontario, not BC. And they got great accolades. So I think it's taking time. I'm jealous of New Zealand, for example, who started out, you know, the same time as we did in the 70s. And we were both doing 40,000 tons. They now do 500,000 tons plus. We do 80,000. So I think we have great room for potential. We make great wines. There's a lot of young people now. I'm always speaking highly of people like Kevin at 27. You know, Marco Piccoli now has got on his own at The Crush, where he's doing Crush for different wineries. So you can actually go there and do a virtual reality winery. So we've come a long way, there's no question. Now we got to get out and market this, tell the world like everybody else does, because, you know, the French and the Italians, and they're spending all of their time traveling around talking about their wines, and we get a lot of respect. I just came back from a tasting, as I said to you, in Paris. Mm-hmm. After I left, I was in Italy doing my Prosecco vineyard, because back to my roots. And Jean-Luc wrote to me, and I should read the email, but it's pretty pretty exciting. So I'm sitting in Italy making some wine, and Jean-Luc writes this, and he was asked, or one of the staff was asked, to attend a tasting at Chateau de Kim. So, Brian, Chateau de Kim is undoubtedly the best dessert wine in the world, bar none. So, basically what he said was, one of his folks went to a tasting at Chateau de Kim in France, the Great Sauterne, and he said the wine showed very well. Now, that would be like going to the Academy Awards and showing very well after the fact when you got Chateau de Kim and a few other dessert wines. So that's the kind of accolades that really put us on the map.
All right. I need to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk to you more about the fact that we've got separate wine industries in separate provinces, and we don't always drink our own stuff. We don't drink our own hooch like we should, Donald. More on that when we come back. I remember years ago when I was still living in Montreal, going on the SAQ website, that is their government liquor store website, and even in the early 2000s, it was very advanced in telling you exactly which product you wanted and which store it was at. And so, Donald, I remember going to one particular SAQ location up in Côte Saint-Luc because I was big into I think I was drinking a lot of Henry of Pelham Bacco Noir back then. And they said they had some of that in stock and not easy to get outside of Ontario. So I went up and I'm looking all over the store and couldn't find it. And finally I stopped and I asked somebody where it was. And he took me to this one small little section. And whereas everything else was labeled under its country of origin, this wine was labeled under a sign that said Divers Pays. Other countries. And that's, some people will scoff and say, oh, well, that's Quebec, but that's really how we treat wine in this country. You go to Western Canada, it's hard to find Ontario wine. They only have Okanagan. We can't get Okanagan wine easily in Ontario or east of Ontario. We don't tend to support our own industry, I would say, with these trade barriers. I know you said you just, stuck your head down and did it, but if we're going to go from 80,000 to 500,000 like the Kiwis, don't we have to start supporting our own industry, getting out of the way of ourselves?
Listen, we could spend hours talking this because I spend half my lifetime trying to come up with some rationale. Bottom line is we got to get rid of the interprovincial barriers. I was sitting with Premier Bennett and Premier Peterson at the 86 Olympics, sorry, not the Olympics, Expo 86, and I had to smuggle my Chardonnay into the Ontario Pavilion because I hadn't met the timeline. So yeah, they're ridiculous barriers. They shouldn't be there, and we should get rid of them. The industry itself has its own problem because we need to work more unified as an industry, as most others do. When California or France or Bordeaux or Burgundy or County come here, they come as an organization. We need to do more of the same. So yeah, the industry sort of, I think, at a very big turning point, and we just need to get our act together. But, it's no different in the fashion industry in Canada, no different in the film industry. Music has broken the mold. Because right now, if you look at the biggest singers in the world, if I'm not mistaken, Drake was a Canadian boy. He's number one.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole list of them I could go through. But
Justin Bieber, Shawn Mendes, and on and on. The Weeknd.
Weeknd, you're right. Sean's an Irishman, isn't he? But The Weeknd, yeah. So I think, they've broken the mold. We just need to follow along and just keep making great wines. And we got to get off our ass and get out there and sell it to the world. Because it's also hard to find Canadian wine anywhere. Whereas, as I said, I'm envious of New Zealand because you can go anywhere in the world and get New Zealand, and they're not giving it away. They're selling premium at premium prices. We've got a great flagship with the ice wine. I've always said it's like an umbrella. We've now been recognized as the world producer for ice wine. Even though we give credit to the Germans, let's be honest, we made it famous globally. Canada ice wine, it just fit. So if that's the umbrella, and they're expecting us to charge so much money for a great wine, let's do the same, bring in the premium Chardonnays, premium Pinot Noirs, which were just given credit in decanter, and let's get out there and sell it. It'll take time. I'm just, a little impatient because I didn't think it would take this long to get the recognition globally. But it's coming, and we just got to work hard. And we appreciate journalists who write about our wines, and we'd like you to write more about them. So this is greatly appreciated. Also helps me to explain a little bit about the history, but more importantly about the future, because I think with the young people, we've got two schools now, Niagara College, and we've got Covey, Cool Climate, Enology and Viticulture Institute. And a lot of the graduates are young ladies, young men who have stayed here and gone back to the farm or working at the wineries. And there's many of them, very successful.
In terms of supporting our own industry, one thing that somebody said to me a little while ago, and I'm not sure if I agree with it, but I can see it being an impediment if there are a lot of people thinking this. And they said, well, Canadian wine's pretty good, but it's overpriced for what you get. A $30 bottle should really be $20 and so on. What would your answer be to them? You're the salesman all these years. What do you say?
Well, I'll tell you, if you want to drive a Ferrari, you can't buy a Chevy. So, I thought, what am I going to tell you? You get what you pay for. And our cost of living is high. It's very difficult to grow grapes in this tiny area. Where I was just in Italy, I drove across the northern from all the way from Prosecco country, Friuli, all the way across to Piemonte. There are thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres of vineyard. Plant them anywhere, hillsides, slopes, flatland. Here we're very restricted. So the argument, you could keep arguing that all the time, but you're going to pay big prices for great French and, upwards of $10,000, $20,000 a bottle for the great first growths for the Burgundies. Domaine La Romanée Conti, Chateau Margaux, Chateau Lafite. But you can also buy a $10 bottle of French wine if you want to drink that stuff. So I think there's a broad spectrum. We as an industry need to get into premiumization. I think I may as well drop the bomb. We got to get rid of the Wine Content Act. And, that was put there for a purpose. We had a short crop. When we weren't growing enough viniferin hybrids, we needed to supplement with some other grapes we imported. And now it's blended. I think we should separate it, make it 100% imported. We still get all the benefits of labor and so on, the whatever it is that, contributes to the profitability of that sector. And then focus on VQA. We've had a 7% market share for the last 10 years. That's an unacceptable
thing. VQA is only 7%?
Yeah, the 23 to 30% that's talked about includes blended wines. So in Ontario, I'm just now, I have this statistic. In BC, they're much, much better because, the West Coast is always much more supportive of their native goods, whether it's California or Oregon. I was looking at the numbers the other day at Oregon and California. It's amazing. I mean, they're up. I've got the numbers somewhere, but I was shocked at the number of acres. It's like over 100,000 acres in both cases.
You told me a story before we started recording about being on a flight recently. And even though you're sitting in the good seats, you're up front, you had to argue to get Canadian wine served to you.
Yeah, I'm doing that for 4 years. Claude Villedé was great in the day when he was president. He insisted on the Chardonnay being on first class in Air Canada. So we were very proud of that. And I even remember putting a video that they put a video in about people coming in. Like when I saw the one today coming back, or yesterday, coming back from Venice, that it was promoting Toronto as a city, great city that it is, and then Calgary and each city across. In this case, it was the wine region. And so all of that helps. And, I cause trouble all the time because if you fly on Qantas, you're not going to be drinking Canadian wine, I can tell you that. Or if you fly on Air France, you're not going to be drinking German wine. So it's just something that we should do. And there was on the flight yesterday, I had to cause a little stir, but I did get a Henry Pelham Riesling and a Trius Cabernet, I think it was a Cabernet Franc.
Both fine wines.
Both fine. And I tasted the others, the imports, and yeah, they were good. They were no different than ours. If you did it blind, I bet you nobody on that airplane could tell me the difference between which country they came from.
What needs to be done next, either by the industry or by government to help? I hear a lot in Ontario because I spend a lot of time at Queen's Park covering provincial politics, that they've got to get rid of this 6.1% excise tax.
Yeah, that's one thing the industry's working on right now, Brian, and it's part of an overall ask of the Ontario government to give the industry a break. And Deloitte Touche recently did a study. I'm sure you've reviewed it. If you haven't, you can get a copy of it. And it's basically suggesting that the wine industry in the Niagara Peninsula, specifically, because it was done for this region, and the industry got together, hired Deloitte, and it basically says that we as the foundation of tourism, which we've been doing for 20 years, we're kind of blessed and cursed being near Niagara Falls, but It does deliver 13 million visitors. And that could generate, I think it was $8 billion was the number that it could generate to enhance the economic development. Now, be clear, when I say economic development, my intent is to shove the economic development above the escarpment. Because one of my pet focuses right now is, and I've been spending time with the industry trying to figure out how we incorporate this request of the government to support us, federal and provincial, and with this new initiative to drive hospitality and tourism to a greater level. And thirdly, get the traffic off the Niagara Peninsula, build the Mid-Peninsula Corridor. And I know people don't like the idea because it's a highway, but if we don't stop developing in on the very restricted fruit lands below the escarpment, which is the only place, with the exception of Prince Edward County and down in Lake Erie North Shore, that we can grow grapes, we're going to run out of land. In 20 years, we've seen what's happened in the last 20 years. If you drive down the QE, we aren't going to have an industry because you can't plant grapes above the escarpment, not commercially viable yet, unless we get 4 or 5 degrees of global warming, which, you know, is certainly impacting the industry. But so there's a number of things that got to be done. And the other thing is the industry really needs to get together as a unified voice, for the simple reason that government will only listen to an industry if it's unified and its ask can't be different sectors asking for different things. Because it's really easy for the government just to say, well, go home, get your act together, and then come back. So, but more importantly, focus on viticulture, growing better quality grapes, and continuing to improve the wine, which you'll see is done in every country. I just came back from Italy, and they're doing as much research as they were 100 years ago to improve, for a number of reasons. One, to adapt to climatic conditions that are changing dramatically in Europe. I mean, Italy's had a devastating season between hail the size of baseballs, floods in Bologna in the middle, and then heat in the south, where Sicily probably abandoned 30-40% of its crop to mildew. Wow. and rain. Yeah, but it was pretty devastating in Europe. So, you know, we have cold, but we learn to manage with it. We have a lot of technology coming out of the research station and out of the schools. But my suggestion to the industry, stop spending all the time lobbying government, which we haven't been very successful at, and let's get out there and sell wine. Let's hire a dozen sommeliers and send them in the marketplace.
Well, you're talking about premiumization. Is that what the word you use? That's a new one to me.
Premiumization. It's just making premium wines and leaving the, quote, I'll exaggerate, leave the baby ducks behind us, stop talking about them, and let's move on to the great Cabernet Francs we make. In Niagara, we do a great job with Pinot Noir. Okanagan, they do a great job with reds because it's a semi-arid desert out there.
Okay, so the Ford government in Ontario is looking at changing how beer and wine is sold. And you know that. There have been primarily two wine companies that have benefited from having their own wine shops. But they're looking at expanding sales to corner stores in different places. Would that help the industry or not matter based on what you're talking about? Because, you know, my experience with Quebec is that you'll get most cities, most neighborhoods will have one store that carries the good stuff, and the rest, you're going in for a quick bottle just to get something because you're out.
Well, they're called dépanneurs. And if you check, that's all bottled bulk wine that comes in and bottled. It was owned by the SAQ, now it's independent, the bottling facility. So is that a solution? If it's done right, I mean, distribution of wine could be done better. The monopoly that we have is a monopoly, it's just that. So I think there are improvements, just like the industry can. I think there's a lot of room for improvement, especially accessibility for the small wineries. Because, you know, as long as they're successful selling fruit at the door, you know, as we call a cellar door. But when we started, there were 6 wineries, all of which have now basically been morphed into the, quote, as you call them, big ones. And I was part of that. It was a survival technique when the government threw us under the bus with the free trade agreement back in the 80s, late 80s. So that distribution is welcome, but at the same time, we got to do it properly, not haphazardly. Mr. Ford has a bad habit like he did with the Greenbelt. It's in, it's out, it's in, it's out. Now he's had to apologize because that was a huge movement against, you know, damaging the Greenbelt. So we don't want the same thing to happen with distribution. It should be done properly. I had a suggestion that I've even given to the government and the LCBO. Why don't we take the vintage stores, which are the specialty stores, take them away from a government agency, which has to be non-committal, generic, if you know what I mean, give that to whoever wants to, you know, license them or buy them, like they did with cannabis, and then let some sommeliers run them that are going to provide outstanding service. Because right now, we used to have wine consultants at the LCBO. I don't think they exist anymore.
I think also,
no, and the liquor board technically is not allowed to tell you, you know, Henry Pelham Baco Noir is better than Cape Springs, Cap Franc or whatever, because that's not, you know, they should do it, in my opinion. We are asking for their advice. So, yeah, I think distribution needs to be looked at. I just hope he doesn't do it haphazardly. He should meet with all the stakeholders. And putting it in the grocery stores, you know, there's all kinds of controversy about what's up going on in the grocery business right now. So do we need to get mixed up in that? Let's just sell our wine. I think the boutiques that the wineries have, you know, they were purchased because basically those were each individual licenses at one time owned by a winery. So since Prohibition, various wineries have bought them. London wineries had a bunch. So when we bought London, we absorbed those 12 stores. When I say we, Vincor. So I've had both feet in both sides, you know, the independent Enniskillen, which we built, and then by necessity had to survive after the free trade agreement and got better distribution because we were able to sell Enniskillen in 140 stores. But they could do a case study at a university of how long it took us to break that rule that wherever the wine was manufactured, only those retail stores owned by that manufacturing permit could sell it. And it goes on and on. We need to get, like, come on, let's get over this. You know, wine to me as an Italian is a food staple. Where I just came from in Italy, like, wine's everywhere. It's like part of the table setting. Whereas here we treat it as alcohol. And I just read this ridiculous report, you know, and once I looked up who wrote it, the Alcohol, Drug, and Addiction Foundation. Oh, was I surprised that they said don't drink too much wine or too much alcohol?
Are these the guys that said no more than two drinks a week?
Yeah, or don't drink any at all. Well, you know, if you're getting paid to sell that propaganda, I guess you're going to stick with that storyline. I have no idea what benefit it's going to be. If you don't want to drink, that's entirely up to you. Don't. But don't tell me where I, you know, consider this a culture. I'm right now even playing with the idea of doing an interview, like a TV series for wine, because there's so much food, chefs, chef competitions, food shows, Food Network. There really isn't one that focuses on wine, but not just wine like us here talking heads. I'm talking about visiting the vineyards all over the world, expressing the winemakers' terroir, you know, all of the different regions, the vintages. It's an exciting business. I just spent 2 weeks in Italy, and I ran out of time. I just should have stayed another 2 weeks just to get a sense of what's going on with this year's harvest.
Donald, it sounds like you've had a pretty good career in the wine business that started out by mistake. So, you know, happy mistakes turned into a great career for you. Thanks so much for the time today. Thanks for your insights.
Brian, it was a great pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Full Comment is a Postmedia podcast. My name's Brian Lilly, your host. This episode was produced by Andre Peru with theme music by Bryce Hall. Kevin Libin is the executive producer. You can subscribe to Full Comment on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, and Amazon Music. You can listen through the app or Alexa-enabled devices, and you can help us out by giving us a rating or leaving a review. And of course, tell your friends all about us. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Brian Lilly.